half the team went to us, the other half went to Microsoft, became Microsoft Office. And we ended up supplying an entire integrated system. Now, that's what I call an entrepreneur who actually went out, discovered, validated, and listened. That would be a great story by itself, if not what happened in the second company. Alan Michaels sells this company to Burroughs 3.5 years later for $400 million. A guy who made up the product, real time, on the whiteboard, actually delivered. Next company, Alan was known as the bad boy of Silicon Valley, but boy, I remember going into with him to Kleiner Perkins, and they asked us what we wanted to do, because here was a check for $10 million for anything we wanted to do. Anything. Make a long story short, Alan takes money, not from Kleiner Perkins. And we go out and build another product. This time, where do you think Alan Michaels was? Was he out in the field?
The golf course.
Golf course? Where was he?
Talking to VCs about how good that idea is.
You bet. He was in the building. Who was outside talking to customers? Who was talking to customers? Still startup. Who was talking to customers or potential customers trying to validate the idea? Sorry? You bet. His VP of marketing. And guess what the customers told him? What do you think they said? What happened the first time down? They didn't need it. In fact, it was worse. They said, this sucks. The worst idea we've ever heard. But if you kind of took off the graphics part and reconfigured the hardware here, you might have a great product. Well, if I did, and I kind of learned from Al, well, if I did that, how many would you buy? Oh, we'd buy a couple hundred. Good enough. So I went back to Alan Michaels. I was the marketeer. I was actually the entire, in hindsight, customer development department. Alan, good news. They hate our product. In fact, they hate it a lot. But we could sell a lot of it if we did X or Y. Now, what do you think Alan Michaels' response was, Lauren? I'm sorry? He wanted to do it. How many think he thought that was a great idea, me coming in with that news? Sounds like you're alone. How many think it was a bad idea? What do you think he said? Anybody? James?
Probably said, what are they now?
What else do you think he said?
He probably said there are several others who wanted that one.
What else? Yeah,
I know what I'm doing. I've done it with that.
Called up to other customers. That
yeah. He said all that later.
Anything to do with VCs?
Yeah. You know what I said? You're fired. And he said it three times that day. Three times. He threw me out of the building three times. Got me in. Just throw me out again. Because you know what I told him? I told him, your baby's ugly. Not only is it ugly, it's terribly ugly. That no one loves your baby. And it's all your baby. Now, this is a lesson in human nature. Because, Lauren, you pointed out the rational response. As somebody who has lived this before, you should kind of go, I got it. And I got firsthand feedback. Boy, I'm really going to learn and live that. You know what? The bad news is, in the first startup, Alan didn't get a memo that said, here's what made you rich. He didn't get the memo that said, hey, fool, it wasn't that your customers loved your first product. It was that you were great at listening and figuring out when someone told you your baby was ugly. You heard it firsthand, and you couldn't dodge that news. You couldn't blame it on someone else. This is the riff off of the why founders have to be involved in customer development. It's about human nature. If you're an engineer, you're going to say, you know, we hire VPs of sales. That's what they're for. You're nodding a lot, Jeremy. Have you lived this or? All right. You'll say, you know what, we'll hire some suit with lots of experience and we'll just tell them what the product is and they'll go out and sell it. And if they come back and say it's unsellable, the first thing you'll say is, after you say you're fired, is, oh, you're just not explaining it correctly. Anybody ever hear that? Now, it could be, but guess what? You have no right to say that because you have no idea how they can explain it. And the whole notion about customer development is to get you personally engaged. At some level, getting feedback from customers continually from day one. And I don't mean turning you all into salespeople, particularly for the technical architect or the chief product designer or the VP of engineering, but enough not to miss a key insight in the field. Because here's another spooky statistic. How many products do you think end up on day one being the product that's actually sold in year three? What percentage? 100? 50? 10?
Less than 1.
Probably less than 10%, depending on industry. Very scary. It's not that you throw out the product. It's that the customers actually teach you which product you're supposed to be building, because they're going to tell you, if you do this continually, what they'll pay for. Now, you could decide that they're all, in some industries, you might actually decide, they're screwed up, they don't get my vision, I'm going to ignore what they're going to say, my founders and my VCs are going to ignore what they're going to say, because I'm right. You know what? There are a group of people like that. And some of them are right. But you've got to consciously make that decision. It should be a conscious decision, not something that happens to you by accident. By the way, anybody think of a couple examples of founders that ignore conventional customer input?
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs. Who else? Anybody else? Who'd work for? Who's founder? Biggest asshole in the world. Yeah. Well, next to Steve Jobs, they like you, so they kind of go in groups. Right? And I'm making this as a point. At the extreme ends, there are founders with good enough instincts, to ignore all conventional wisdom and be right. What you need to decide is that you. And if those aren't your skills, like you understand, then you've got to substitute a methodology for emulating domain expertise or instinct. And that's what customer development is about. Does that help at all? So the first two steps of the customer development process really are this iterative OODA loop. Classes to show you my white guy goes to India pictures, which is really amusing. The next two steps are what happens when you think you have found a repeatable and scalable pattern and you now want to create a company. And that's called customer creation. And then the last step is company building. That is the customer development process. We're going to be spending the semester going through all four steps. That's all the class is about. And we put all this together, customer development and agile product development, and you end up with a lean startup that builds low-burn companies, low-cost market risk testing, and organized around this notion of learning and discovery versus execution. It's an interesting phrase. Learning and discovery versus execution. Startups historically start on day one. We're building the product, we're executing, we're going to first customer ship, and we're selling. Customer development says something very different. It assumes we know nothing. Execution assumes you know everything. Execution says every hypothesis that Jameson's done in his business plan was correct. I would take his business plan, throw it back at him, sorry to pick on you, and say, there's nothing in here that's correct. Get out of the building and prove to me the key critical hypotheses by learning and discovering firsthand. I believe this is the right model for current economic conditions. And it's probably the next wave of capital efficient startups. Let me make an observation about customer development, by the way. Anybody do a company in the internet bubble? Anybody been around? How'd you do?
How many still around?
Did you do okay, or how many do okay?
Personally, you know, I don't.
All right. Anybody else? So let me suggest, if we were in the internet bubble, and you came to me holding, let me have the class text. Can I have that? I saw it. Yeah. Hold it up. If you came waving this text to me in a bubble, I'd rip it out of your hands, throw it in the garbage, and go, what are you, out of your mind? Go ride the bubble. That is, there are times when markets become irrational, that there are times to suspend rational processes. Seriously. And by the way, sometimes it happens in specific industries. Biotech had a bubble by itself. Telecom had a bubble by itself. Internet startups had it. It was frothy in Web 2.0 here for a while. When you're in a bubble, sometimes you can make money just by playing the bubble. I will contend that that's not true 95% of the time. For the 5% of the time that it's frothy and bubbly, you know, forget the rules. But this class is about the 95% of the time when you truly just have to build a business. And that is what this is about. Make sense? Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. Last part. Some of the reading was about business plans and... I think I just want to share this with you. Who said there, somebody said, why did you write a business plan? So I made that comment. Who was it? Somebody said, was it you?
No,
ah, sorry. What did they say? Hebrew or English? No, English. No, you heard. Oh, you were there too. Oh. How many of you actually have written a business plan for a VC? For a business plan? Right. How many of you have done a PowerPoint demo for a VC? I'm going to tell you a dirty secret. 8 startups. I've never written a business plan. The longest deck was 13 slides. Now, you might conclude, therefore, Steve is saying business plans are bad ideas. I think business plans are wonderful internal company organizing documents. We confuse them with a document that will raise money. They're not offering documents. They're, to me, personally, my opinion, they are the world's best organizing pieces of paper. Why? Because besides VCs require it, it really helps you gather all your hypotheses, your business model assumptions, all in one place. I can't think of a more useful place to do that. The reason why is, in customer development, we use the business plan as the place that we get all the hypotheses we're going to be testing. But it is not a document that I ever go into a venture capital. And in fact, I will show you, and some of our guests will show you, much better presentations of the lessons learned fundraising pitches that even today, after seeing a good number of them, will stop VCs in their tracks. Stop them in their tracks. Traditional venture pitches follow the business plan model, which is here's our market, here's our competition, here's the potential revenue, here's the idea. We could, by the end of this class, put together a presentation for all of you that will truly stop an investor in their tracks. And it's based on using the business plan as a way to gather your assumptions, but not as the selling document. Does any of this make sense? When you hear Steve doesn't like business plans, not at all. I just don't like it for the way that you think, you know, submit a plan and somebody's going to read all beautiful 95 pages of formatted Helvetica text and whatever. It doesn't work that way. Now, worse, if you ever pitch to me when you're out of the class and you have particularly 65 pages of wonderfully 12-year forecast and whatever, I always ask, so what are the 6 assumptions about your business model? And we usually disagree by assumption 3, which completely invalidates, you know, all 65 pages of your financial document. So I tend to go for, tell me the basic assumptions about a plan, and then let's go test them. Now, what's wrong with a plan is what we'll fix in customer development. A business plan is static and it's execution-oriented. It assumes you're right. We have about 10 more minutes. Let me talk about the value of models. A model is a shorthand for a complicated idea. Anybody ever read or have to do the Timmons book? Anybody see Timmons for venture capital? Jeff Timmons wrote one of the great texts about the early stage ventures. I forget what it's called, but his name is Jeff, G-E-O-F-F Timmons. Great book, 412 pages. And the Timmons model of entrepreneurship, all 412 pages, it's about opportunity, resources, team. Point is, you could get 412 pages of a complicated idea on one diagram. Jeff Moore, Crossing the Chasm, 212 pages. Moore's entire idea, there's a chasm. What I'm trying to point out is that that models are shorthand for complicated big ideas. Here's the chasm. Oh, I got it. Early stage customers, mainstream market. Oops, we didn't realize this. We're screwed unless we realize that sales go to zero for a while. What's interesting is we're introducing new products and new companies. New product introduction models should be a checklist of what to do and when to do it, tell us about market size and business case, and they try to ensure that products match the market and that there are technology and development gates. So the venture capital model of a startup kind of is incredibly stupidly simple. Oh, thanks for your concept and business plan. You guys go off and do product development, and every board meeting we'll ask you where you are in alpha and beta, and then we'll have a launch first customership. And then you're going to execute to the drunken business plan thing you thought we didn't like actually believe in, but we're going to let you execute to that so then we can cram you down later. Plan. Right? That's the, you know, anybody ever seen this model before? Right? All your VCs don't believe the complicated stage gate models. They're operating off of this. Early alpha, beta, first customership, what's our burn rate? That's it. Fair? Anybody use stage gate at all? Their company? Or anything like it? Have you seen this before? Right. This is a product management model. Here's a whole set of product introduction models. Turns out lots of companies have ways to manage products. But the product development process works great for some new products, fails miserably for others. Products are usually late, overcost, and fail to understand customer needs. So, question is why? My suggestion is because they confuse product development process with customers. And they treat all startups the same. The customer development model thing I just showed you, those four steps, solves the problem about a process that reduces market risk, gets founder commitment, gets cross-functional organization commitment, and is based on solid homework. So my model that I first drew before I drew the customer development model was a simple sketch of what life looks like to an entrepreneur. Looked like this. Except when I showed that to Jerry Engel, the teacher at Berkeley, he said, Steve, you need something a little more complicated than that to teach class. So, therefore, we came up with a customer development model. And, as I said, the value of model is a shorthand. And this class teaches this customer development model that's parallel to product development. And so what we'll be talking about this entire semester is this bottom diagram. We're assuming you're going to do some agile methodology. We're not going to discuss that in this class. We are assuming that you're going to stay synchronized with that methodology, but the class is about this. And so, next week, Think about the companies you want to analyze for your application exercises. Start thinking about who do you want on your team. Review the syllabus and read chapter 2 of the text and the in and out case. And I will now take questions. Come on. You have any idea what I just said for the last 2 hours? Elizabeth, you're looking like, what did I just say? You're going to show up next week?
I don't know.
I don't know either. Oh, you're not showing up. I'm not showing up. Any other questions? Yes.
Why do you say that at least the first 2 sides of your model don't work in a big company? I would think that the customer discovery and the validation probably generic enough that it should work.
It's a great question. Theoretically, this is so rational. As you would think, gee, in a large corporation, this is just fine. We'll be talking about the other issues in corporations about how you invest in entrepreneurial activities and what types of returns you need to promise to corporations for new ventures that are completely disruptive and new technologies. This works great for product line extensions. This works horribly. And I'll give you an example. Apple Newton, favorite technology, or Kodak and digital products. This is really hard when you need huge resources that don't generate bottom line returns for a large corporation immediately. You have this conundrum of not being able to run at a loss while you might have a clear vision that your market's being eaten up from the bottom side, because you have constraints that, believe it or not, that a startup doesn't. A startup is designed to lose, but a ton of money. A profitable company, you cannot look your CEO in the eye and say, we need to run 3 years at $200 million losses, and I don't know if we're going to nail it, versus the VP of sales going in and say, just give me another 50 salespeople. Even though you know you're in a declining business. It happens all the time. It's why, believe it or not, who was it? I'm going to get his name wrong. Joseph Schumpeter? Yeah. What's his
name? Schumpeter.
Thank you. Say it again.
Schumpeter.
Yes. If you haven't read 1940, Creative Destruction, basically was the first guy to articulate this notion of what happens in large corporations and why it's actually small startups that eat them up from the bottom end. And Christensen's the latest version of that. And we'll talk about this throughout the course. I'll give you some good examples. Other questions?
So given that you're pretty much saying that there's going to be effectively potentially large changes to your business plan or what you execute as you go along,
yes.
What is the... I mean, if both you and the VC believe in this, what does it mean when you pitch an idea to a VC? Do you say, well, this is sort of what we're going to start up at, and then give me a few $1 million while I go discover myself?
So it depends who you are, what state of the company you're pitching. But startups I tend to bring into VCs are ones that have actually bit the bullet, somehow figured out how to get themselves funded, started, or some traction. On angel money, on relatives, et cetera, where they could come in with a lessons learned presentation, not a business plan. Now, lessons learned presentation, and I'll give you the extreme of my classes at Stanford. I'm teaching in the engineering school. I don't want to see an idea. I want to see that you started the website in your dorm and you have 1,000 users in the next 10 weeks. Well, no one's ever asked us to actually do anything real. Congratulations, welcome to my class. Now, imagine, you're in material science. Oh, but Steve, it's just a theoretical. Oh, really? What are you working on? Oh, this nanomaterial, filter. Great. I want to see a sample in 10 weeks. Oh, it's going to take us 6 months. 10 weeks. Damn it. You don't show up in 10 weeks with just a whatever. This notion of I'm going to send you paper versus I'm going to force you down the process of validating a set of hypotheses. In the engineer's case, in some of the material science guys, it's just show me the next step. Oh, no, it's a 6 month, whatever, it's a 2 year. No. Show me a shortcut that validates some of the key risks. Oh, I can do that. Does that make sense at all? And we'll talk about what some examples are, and they differ from our Right? In biotech, it's impossible to do that. Show me how we're going to shortcut phase three. You know, you go to jail if you do that. They have gone to jail, but, you know, big black box warning. But in some industries, it's very easy to go from a business. You can imagine Web2L business, very easy. How come I'm not doing that? Well, because when money's loose, you don't need to do it. Other questions? All right, we'll see how many of you we see next week. John, are there questions?